Hi, this is Carrie, and I'm going to continue on in your chronic neurological problems PowerPoint with seizure disorder, and this actually starts on slide 22. So if you'd like to turn there and follow along, that might be helpful for you. So a seizure is a paroxysmal uncontrolled electrical discharge of neurons in the brain interrupting normal function. Usually this generally comes from a group of hyper-excitable neurons called a focus. The seizures are seen when discharge from a focus spreads to other areas of the brain, thereby recruiting normal neurons and discharge abnormally along the focus. If a seizure activity invades a very limited part of the brain, a partial or local seizure occurs. In contrast, if a seizure activity spreads to a large portion of the brain, a generalized seizure develops, and we are going to talk about each of those different types here as well. Generally, we're going to look at other things that could accompany a seizure disorder. Seizures result from metabolic disturbances, again, are not considered epilepsy if a seizure ceases when the underlying condition is treated. So we'll talk about epilepsy versus a seizure disorder and what that means. So if there is no other trigger for these seizures, it's known as epilepsy. If there is another trigger, something that is setting off a seizure that we can identify, then it's just a seizure disorder brought on by a different cause. So possible other causes are related to metabolic disturbances. Can be acidosis, electrolyte imbalance, hypoglycemia, hypoxemia, alcohol, or barbiturate withdrawal. And we talked about that with the CWA scale. I know in clinical some of us have actually seen that. I think you'll talk about that more again in mental health. You'll also possibly dehydration or water intoxication may be a cause. Also, hyperthermia is another one you could put on that cause. You can have hyperthermic seizures, and we did mention that in class. So let's spend a little bit of time origin possibilities related to extracranial disorders. So if it's not starting in the brain, what else could be a trigger? So we need to think about various organs within the body. First, we'll start with the heart. Any changes in blood flow through the arteries can actually be a signal for the start of a seizure. Hypertension, increased pressures within the vessels. As we think about the lungs, kidney, and liver, if any of these are not working correctly, they all work to help filter and keep our blood working effectively. They're carrying oxygen, it's filtering out impurities and electrolytes, it's helping to digest. The liver is helping to, as our filter, and helping to keep the good things in our blood we need. So if any of these are not working correctly, we can have an increase in toxins within the bloodstream that actually can then set off a seizure. We have some autoimmune disorders, SLE, diabetes, type 1 can actually be autoimmune. So if the body's attacking itself in certain areas, it also can set off a seizure. Septicemia is another thing. You'll have high fevers with this one, but you'll also have increased increased bacteria floating around in the blood. So if that's not treated appropriately as well, then that can actually set off a seizure. So those would be secondary disorders that we would want to treat. Once we had treated and fixed the problem there, hopefully the seizure itself would go away. Now I want to talk just a little bit about epilepsy. The term epilepsy refers to a group of chronologic neurological disorders characterized by recurrent seizures brought on by excessive excitability of neurons within the brain. Symptoms can range from brief periods of unconsciousness to violent convulsions. Patients may also experience problems with learning, memory, and mood, which can be just as troubling as the seizure itself. So in the United States, we generally have quite a few with this. 3 million people have been diagnosed recently with epilepsy. We see it more often in the older we get, so over 60 years of age. National trends do show that an incidence of epilepsy is decreasing in children, but increasing in the elderly. The longer we are keeping people alive, the more we are seeing this. New cases are generally more common in African Americans and in the socially disadvantaged populations. So socioeconomic status does play a role here as well. In some populations, including those with Alzheimer's disease or stroke, a person with a parent who has epilepsy are also at higher risk to develop epilepsy. There is between 60 to 70% of patients actually can be rendered seizure-free with the use of medications. So a diagnosis of epilepsy does not necessarily mean a life sentence of seizures, because medications do tend to work for the majority of the people. But unfortunately, this does mean that 30 to 40% are not affected and do still experience seizures. Direct cost for epilepsy is estimated to be approximately $15.5 billion per year. As we're looking at the next slide, common causes during the first 6 months of life. So if they are going to have it early on, it's generally a birth injury, congenital birth defect involving the CNS, infections, again, the hyperthermic seizures you may see, inborn errors of metabolism. If genetically there was something wrong, then we might see a seizure. Again, common causes for the little bit older, 2 to 20, birth injury, infection, trauma, genetics. Common causes between the next age group are 20 to 30-year-olds, structural lesions. Now we start to see more brain tumors, trauma. Our biggest age of trauma and injury to the head and the brain is actually between 20 and 30 years of old. We're also seeing more vascular disease along with coronary artery disease starting in that age group as well. Common causes after the age of 50 include strokes, cerebrovascular lesions, metastatic brain tumors. So 75% of the seizure disorders are considered idiopathic, though, and basically that means they really haven't determined the cause. The role of heredity in seizure disorder is difficult to determine. Some families have been known to carry the predisposition in the form of a low threshold to seizure-producing stimuli. And so, again, trauma, disease, any high fevers, they're known to have seizures more easily than others. But in epilepsy, abnormal neurons undergo spontaneous firing. So any stimulus that causes the cell membrane of a neuron to depolarize induces a tendency towards spontaneous firing, therefore causes a seizure. This firing spreads to adjacent or distant areas of the brain. If activity involves the whole brain, a generalized seizure is going to occur. On the next slide, slide 27, it states that often the area of the brain from which epileptic activity arises is found to have gliosis, the thought to interfere with normal chemical and structural environments of the neuron, therefore making it likely for it to fire abnormally. Astrocytes are now believed also to play a key role in recurring seizures. These astrocytes actually release glutamate, which triggers synchronous firing of the neurons. Therefore, when we look at our medications, we're going to look at some drug therapy focused on suppressing astrocyte signaling and decreasing glutamate release. Maybe the mechanisms by which we're going to see the best seizure control attained. So we'll look at those again a little bit more in depth when we get to our medications. The signs and symptoms that we're going to see include... Well, let's start by dividing them into two classes. We have generalized and partial seizures, because depending on where the seizure is located, only the full brain or part of the brain, we're going to have different symptoms. So it's all going to be based on the site of electrical disturbance and how much of the brain that entails. A partial seizure is also known as a focal seizure, and we'll talk about that. First, this slide, let's look at the generalized seizures. Those can be divided into tonic-clonic, atypical absent seizures, typical absent seizures, and other types of generalized seizures. We'll have partial seizures, and there's also psychogenic seizures. So there is an international classification system in a table found in your textbook that talks about how all of these different seizures are classified. And over the next few pages, I'll hopefully help you get a deeper understanding about what each of these will look like. So let's break them down a little bit more. So the next slide has a diagram of the seizure classification system. First, we're going to decide, is it only a partial seizure or is it a generalized seizure? So a partial seizure, the patient is going to remain conscious. The only thing that may change will be their level of consciousness. They're either going to be alert through the whole thing and know what's going on, or they're going to have an altered level of consciousness. If they remain alert, it's going to be known as a simple partial seizure. If just their level of consciousness is going to change slightly, they're not going to go unconscious, they just may become confused, maybe lethargic for a little while, then that is going to be known as a complex partial seizure. On the other side, we have the generalized seizures. And that is divided into basically two subcategories as well. You have a probable altered consciousness. So they did lose consciousness. is the main thought there. So you can that it will be classified as a generalized tonic-clonic seizure or an absent seizure. Each of those have different characteristics that we will talk about. The brief or possible altered level of consciousness under generalized seizure, they're not quite sure they lost consciousness. It may be even just for a brief period, but not for any sustained length of time. And those seizures then are the myoclonic seizures, the tonic, clonic, as well as atonic. So let's focus a little bit more on these. Again, as the next slide just talks about some general manifestations, the seizures themselves generally progress through a set of phases. And the prodromal phase is the first phase, and it precedes the seizure with signs or activities. So there may be some things that they see or that they know are stimuli for the seizure to come on. The oral phase, usually that's your sensory warning. We talked about auras with headaches, with the migraines. This is basically the same concept. They can have some of those same features that they had with a migraine headache here with a seizure. That's more of a sensory warning that they're going to be having. The ictal phase of a seizure is the actual seizure that's occurring itself, the full seizure. And the post-ictal phase is the rest and recovery. And this can take minutes to hours depending on the severity of the seizure. And again, patient safety throughout this entire process is going to be very, very important. So let's talk about some of the signs and symptoms of the generalized seizure. So characteristics characterized by bilateral synchronized epileptic discharges in the brain from the seizure onset. Generally, no warning or aura as the entire brain is affected. So it just kind of happens to the entire brain. Again, it's a generalized seizure, so they're going to lose consciousness. It can either be brief or for longer periods of time. And I want to take just a minute here and talk about the term seizure versus convulsions. And hopefully we'll clear this up a little bit in your mind, because the term seizure and convulsion are not the same. Seizure is a general term that applies to all types of epileptic events. On the other hand, the convulsion has more limited meaning, applying only to abnormal motor phenomena, for example, the jerking movement that occurs during a tonic, clonic, or a grand mal attack. Therefore, although the convulsions may be called seizures, it is not correct to call all seizures convulsions. Absent seizures, for an example, manifest brief periods of unconsciousness, which may or may not be accompanied by any involuntary movement at all. So since not all epileptic seizures involve convulsions, we will refer to the agents that treat epilepsy as anti-epileptic drugs rather than anticonvulsants. So when you're thinking about those two different types of medications and what they do, the anti-epileptics versus the anticonvulsants, hopefully that helps clear things up a little bit in your mind. All right, let's now break the generalized seizures up into the different categories. We're going to start with a tonic-clonic seizure, also known as the grand mal seizure. In the tonic-clonic seizure, neural discharge spreads throughout both hemispheres of the cerebral cortex. These seizures manifest as major convulsions characterized by a period of muscle rigidity, which is known as the tonic phase, followed by synchronous muscle jerks, known as the clonic phase. Tonic-clonic seizures often cause urination, but not defecation. Convulsions may be preceded by a loud cry caused by forceful expiration of air through the vocal cords. Tonic-clonic seizures are accompanied by marked impairment of consciousness and are followed by a period of CNS depression, referred to as the post-ictal state. The seizure itself generally lasts about 90 seconds or less. Cyanosis, excessive salivation, and tongue or cheek biting may occur as the muscles are clenching and jerking. Post-ictal phase for the tonic-clonic seizure is characterized by muscle soreness, fatigue, and patients are just confused, generally very lethargic and tired, and they're going to sleep usually for many hours after a tonic-clonic or grand mal seizure. They really, truly may not feel normal for days afterwards, and they generally have no recollection of the seizure itself. Let's talk about an absent seizure known as a petit mal seizure. These are characterized by loss of consciousness for a brief time, generally about 10 to 30 seconds. This usually involves mild symmetrical motor activity, such as eye blinking, but may occur with no other motor activity at all. The patient may experience hundreds of absent seizures attacks a day, and these seizures occur primarily in children and usually cease during the early teen years. So, and if you think about absent seizures, it's just that. You may not even realize they are having one because they just appear to be kind of spacing off for a period of time, if you want to put it that way. EEG demonstrates patterns unique to this type of seizure. Again, if they're having them 100 times a day, an EEG should be able to catch it during the seizure, and they will be able to tell through the EEG. Generally often precipitated by hyperventilation and flashes of light. But again, this one, absence, there is not much there that you actually see, and that you can have multiple ones during the day. Atypical absent seizures actually are characterized by staring spells and other signs and symptoms. Atypical absent seizures and just the atypical absent seizures, some places don't really specify the difference between them because there isn't much difference between them. EEG demonstrates atypical spike-like wave patterns, usually greater or less than 3. So you're going to bring them in with an absent seizure, and then it's going to be typical or atypical. And for our purposes of understanding seizures, you do not need to understand the difference of that. I want to look a little bit here at myoclonic seizures on the next slide. That is a seizure consistent of sudden muscle contractions that last for just a second. The seizure activity may be limited to one limb, which has a focal myoclonus area in the brain, or it may involve the entire body, which is known as the massive myoclonus that infects the brain. It can be forceful enough to actually cause patients to fall. And it may be brief, and it may actually occur in clusters as well. So they will watch patients carefully and watch them for injury. Atonic seizures are talked about on the next slide, and these seizures are characterized by sudden loss of muscle tone. Atonic, so if we think about the word, that should make sense to us. They're going to have loss of muscle tone. They're going to be their muscles are going to be atonic. If seizure activity is limited to the muscles of the neck, they're just going to have a head drop, so their head is going to fall down to their chest. However, if muscles of the limbs and trunk are involved, a drop attack actually can occur. This actually causes the patient to suddenly collapse. Atonic seizures, again, generally we mainly see in younger children. This actually, with the atonic seizures, we are the greatest risk for head injury. And generally, the patients who have atonic seizures will wear a helmet. So if you've seen people walking around with helmets, generally they're at a high risk for a type of seizure. Possibly that seizure would be an atonic type. Tonic seizures involve sudden onset and a decrease of exterior muscle tone. Again, the patients often fall with this. Clonic seizures begin with a loss of consciousness and a sudden loss of muscle tone followed by limb jerking. These are generally rarely diagnosed alone and are incorporated into other ones we have already discussed. So it's not important that you generally understand the tonic versus the clonic, but just know that what happens with each one, and you should be able to understand the right type of protection we need to do for each patient. All right, those cover the generalized seizures I want to focus on. Now I would like to talk about partial seizures. Partial seizures refer to as a partial focus seizure caused by focal irritations. It generally begins in a specific region of the cortex of the brain, and it can be generally confined to one side of the brain itself. So these, again, are a major class of seizures according to the International Classification System. They're referred to as a partial focal seizure because they're caused by focal irritation. They manifest with unilateral symptoms and arise from a localized brain involvement. Partial seizures begin in a specific region of the cortex as indicated by the EEG and usually by clinical signs and symptoms. For example, If a discharging focus is located in the medial aspect of the postcentral gyrus of the brain, the patient may experience paresthesias and tingling or numbness in the legs on the opposite side of the focus, which should make sense to us after our discussion with our strokes. Partial seizures may be confined to one side of the brain and remain partial or focal in nature, or they may involve the entire brain, culminating in the generalized tonic-clonic seizure. Any tonic-clonic seizure that is preceded by an aura or warning, that tells you that it's a partial seizure that generalizes secondarily, because remember we talked about the generalized seizures themselves should not have an aura because it involves a massive part of the brain. So if they do happen to have an aura, it's a partial seizure that has generalized. Unlike the primary generalized tonic-clonic seizure, the secondary generalized seizure may result in transient neurologic deficits postictally. This is called Todd's paralysis, or there's a focal weakness, which resolves after a varying length of time. All right, if we look again at the next slide, it talks a little bit more. The partial seizures are divided into simple and complex. Partial seizures themselves are further divided into simple, which simple motor or sensory phenomena occur, or the complex partial seizure, which has more complex symptoms. So simple partial seizures with elementary symptoms do not involve loss of consciousness and rarely last longer than a minute. They may involve motor, sensory, or autonomic phenomena, or a combination of these. The terms focal motor, focal sensory, and Jacksonian have been used to describe seizures of the simple partial type. So if we look to complex partial seizures, the most common complex partial seizure involves lip smacking and automatisms, which is repetitive movements that may not be appropriate. These are often called psychomotor seizures. The patient may continue an activity that was initiated before the seizure, such as counting out change or picking up items from a grocery shelf, but after the seizure does not remember the activity performed during the seizure. Other automatisms are less organized, such as picking at clothes, fumbling with objects, whether they're real or imaginary, or simply walking away. On the next slide, slide 41, there's a variety of sensory motor symptoms that occur during a complex partial seizure, including distortions of visual or auditory sensations and vertigo. There actually may be alterations in memory, such as feelings of having experienced an event before, so they can have actually deja vu, what we call experiences, or alterations in thought process. There is actually, they can actually have alterations in their sexual functioning or sexuality, and it can vary from hyposexuality to hypersexuality. In addition, some anti-seizure drugs that they may take can actually decrease sexual drive due to sedation, and others can actually cause erectile dysfunction. And this is important because we need to address their lives, because they're going to be on these medications for a long period of time. So we just need to make sure that we're thinking through those things and helping them with that aspect of their life as well. Though at some points that can be a little bit uncomfortable, but it does need to be addressed. It's just as uncomfortable for them sometimes as it is for us. So status epilepticus is a state of is a state of continuous seizure activity, or a condition in which seizures recur in rapid succession without return to consciousness between seizures. It is the most serious complication of epilepsy and is a neurologic emergency. Status epilepticus can occur due to any type of seizure. During repeated seizures, the brain uses more energy than it can be supplied. The neurons themselves become exhausted and cease to function. Permanent brain damage may result. Tonic-clonic status epilepticus is the most dangerous because it can cause ventilatory insufficiency, hypoxemia, cardiac dysrhythmias, hyperthermia, and systemic acidosis, all of which can be very fatal. So status epilepticus is a major disorder we need to think about and treat accordingly. Patients who lose consciousness during a seizure are at greatest risk for seizure injury or even death. Subclinical seizures are also a form of status epilepticus, and it talks about these in the book. But within these subclinical seizures, the patient is sedated because they are having a procedure. So we can't really tell that they're having a seizure. So they do not have the external signs because of the sedating medication that they've been given. So let me give you an example of that. There may be a patient who is sedated for ventilatory purposes in the ICU, so possible head injury, but they can't experience a seizure without physical but they could experience a seizure without the physical movements because they're on a paralytic because of being intubated. So we're not going to see the movement or the jerking that the body experiences because of the seizure itself. Such seizures may be missed by healthcare providers providing care for the patients because of the medications we give. So we need to just be in tune to trying to watch for other disturbances that could bring on the seizure. Seizures can occur for pregnant women as well, and these can actually cause potential complications for the pregnant female and her baby, especially depending on the severity of the seizure. People with epilepsy have a mortality rate that is 2 to 3 times the rate of the general population. Again, some of this is due to the seizure disorder, and some of this is due to the safety issues of the person when they're having the seizure and where they are located when they have the seizure. 40% of the deaths are epilepsy related. They're usually caused by accidents occurring from the seizures. And they could also be from suicide, treatment-related death, death due to underlying disease, and a term now called sudden unexplained death in epilepsy. It's another term where they just find patients dead and are not quite sure what happened or if it was just the severity of the seizure and the metabolic changes that occurred in the body that actually caused the patient to pass away. Other complications include the social stigma. It interferes with the values of self-control, conformity, and independence. Patients who have been diagnosed with seizure disorder, especially epilepsy, maybe have a hard time finding a job, driving, possibly education, depending on where what that seizure disorder is. And as we go through the next slides about patient safety and education, we'll talk about some of the different restrictions, especially with driving a car. Very unsafe if you're driving and would happen to have a seizure, not only for you, but for anybody riding with you or any oncoming traffic or people you may hit with the car. So a patient may develop ineffective coping methods because of the psychosocial problems associated with having a seizure disorder. So again, caring for the whole person is going to be very, very important. Diagnosis is going to be something to think about. We need to have accurate, comprehensive description of the seizure with the patient's health history. And EEG, if you're going to remember any diagnostic test for epilepsy, remember the EEG. It may or may not be real helpful based on the information it gets, especially if it's not caught when the seizure is occurring. It may not give a lot of helpful information, but it is one test that actually can provide some if we find it during a seizure. They may also draw CBC, serum chemistries, liver and kidney function, UA. Again, we need to rule out all those other disorders that could bring on a secondary seizure. CT or MRI in new onset seizures to rule out any structural problems. So they're not actually diagnosing the seizure, but any other structural abnormalities that may be there. If we're looking at diagnostics, now that we're done with that diagnosis, actually, I want to talk a little bit about drug therapy and drug care. Anti-epileptic medications. Usually most seizures themselves do not require professional emergency medical care because they're self-limiting and rarely cause bodily injury. However, if the status epilepticus occurs, if significant bodily harm occurs, or if the event is a first-time seizure, medical care should be sought immediately. And generally, patients who have multiple seizures are going to be on an anti-seizure medication. So how anti-epileptic drugs work, I want to just spend a minute talking about these medications in general. The anti-epileptic drugs work by suppressing the discharge of neurons within the seizure focus and actually suppressing propagation of the seizure activity from the focus to other areas of the brain. So it actually suppresses the neurons itself and therefore as well prevents it from traveling to other areas of the brain. However, until recently, we didn't know how these effects were achieved. It now appears that nearly all AEDs act through five basic mechanisms. They suppress sodium influx. They suppress calcium influx. They actually promote potassium influx. They block the receptors for glutamate. and put the potentiation of your GABA or your gamma aminobutyric acid. So they work by many different ways, and for this test, you don't necessarily need to know more specifics about each of those, but these drugs do some really neat things, especially the newer ones. As always, the newer generation usually have fewer side effects and are safer, and that's the same here as well. The principle of drug therapy is to begin with a single drug based on the patient's age and weight, type and frequency and cause of the seizure. And they're going to increase that dose of that medication until all seizures are controlled, or they're going to see toxic side effects. Our drug therapy is actually aimed at prevention, stabilizing the nerve cell membranes, and preventing the spread of epileptic discharge. 70% of our patients, again, 60 to 70% are controlled with medication, so it's a great thing. Some of these newer drugs, you can see that there's a list of older and newer drugs there on the table, are broad spectrum and appear to be effective for multiple seizure types. And so that's going to be very important. A lot of times they like to use the newer medications for them. The one wonderful thing that we can do with anti-epileptic drugs is monitor drug serum levels. We can measure them to make sure that they're not becoming toxic. Yay for that. Technology can be wonderful. The next slide talks about a few more medications. Phenobarbital may be used to treat patients whose seizure disorders are refractory to other drugs. So phenobarbital may not be used. It's limited because it causes aplastic anemia and liver toxicity. So you're not going to see that one used as much anymore as it used to be because of its side effects. Lyrica, I know you've seen commercials on TV. Those of you who actually get to watch TV have seen the commercials for Lyrica, and this can be used as an add-on for control of partial seizures that are not successfully managed with a single medication. So we can add that one on. There are different medications there for absent seizures. You do not need to know those specifics there, although Depakote and Clonopin are pretty common ones, as well as Aerontin, just anti-seizure meds in general. Once someone has static epilepticus, we're going to usually give them some Ativan and Valium to help them through that seizure as well. Most must be followed with long-acting medications, so we have to look at the drugs and how are we going to prevent seizures in the future. So they're looking at many things. As we look at the different types of drugs, as they're thinking about drug selection, and we've talked a little bit about that over these last couple slides. Many AEDs are selective for specific seizure disorders. Dilantin, for example, is used to treat tonic, clonic, and partial seizures, but not an absent seizure. Only one drug, Depakote or valproic acid, appears effective against practically all forms of epilepsy. Since most AEDs are selective for certain seizure disorders, effective treatment requires a proper match between the drug and the seizure. To make this match, the seizure type must be accurately diagnosed. Very often, patients may try several anti-epileptic meds before regimen that is both effective and well-tolerated can be established. Initially, the treatment should be done with just one medication, and if that drug fails, it should be discontinued and a different one should be tried. If the second drug fails, then they can actually treat with a different AED, or they can start a combination of AED medications and see if they work. Once this trial period is over and a drug has been selected, we're going to keep it on for a certain amount of time to make sure it is effective. During this time, there is no guarantee that the seizures will be controlled, and until seizure control is certain, the patient should be warned not to participate in driving or other activities that could be hazardous if a seizure would occur. So we have to do a lot of education. So patients with seizures really feel isolated and debilitated because we're taking away some of their independence until we can get their seizure activity under control. During the process of drug evaluation, adjustments in dosages are often needed. No drug should be considered ineffective until it has been tested in sufficient high dosage and for a reasonable amount of time. So understanding the drug plasma levels can be a valuable tool for establishing dosage and evaluating the effectiveness of the specific drug. So some ways patients can do that is by keeping a seizure frequency chart The chart should be kept by the patient or family member and should contain a complete record of all seizure events. This record will enable the prescriber of the medication to determine if treatment has been effective. As nurses, we should also teach the patient how to create and use a seizure frequency chart. All right. When we're thinking about withdrawing anti-epileptic drugs, that's something really important for all of these anti-seizure medications. Some forms of epilepsy actually do undergo spontaneous remission, and therefore discontinuing treatment may be appropriate, but there's no firm guidelines to indicate how to appropriately withdraw an anti-epileptic medication. However, what we do know is it needs to be over a slow period of time. Generally, needs to be withdrawn over 6 weeks to several months. Failure to gradually reduce the dosage is a frequent cause of many of the side effects. If a patient is taking two drugs to control seizures, they should be withdrawn sequentially, not simultaneously, so one at a time. Otherwise, we can actually induce the seizure if we withdraw them too quickly. So let's go on to the next slide for collaborative care. As we are looking at these different forms of care, obviously a theurological assessment needs to be involved. We're still talking about different medications here. We need to look at nystagmus. They could have, that is fine, rapid jerking movements of the eyes. When we are looking for that neurological assessment, what it's telling us basically is also if they're developing toxic levels of the medication. So if they're having any of these symptoms, obviously we should be drawing a blood level of that anti-epileptic medication to see if we've reached toxicity. They may have problems with hand and gait coordination. They may have mental slowness that relates with our cognitive functioning. They're going to have an altered level of consciousness, general alertness. So we're going to look at that and see if it's changed at all. Other side effects outside of the CNS could include rashes, hyperplasia of the gingiva, and that is actually the most common side effect of Dilantin, excessive overgrowth of the gingival tissue within the mouth. If you Google image that, you'll have some really interesting pictures where the gums actually are so swollen and are coming down partway down their teeth. And this is seen especially in young adults, and this can be limited by good dental hygiene, including regular toothbrushing and flossing, but that's a common side effect that you'll see. There can be blood dyscrasias, and that can happen from decreased bone marrow stimulation and production of cells. It also can have effects on the liver and kidney, so they can be hepatotoxic. Common side, other things to think about, you just need to understand these so we can treat the patient accordingly and help them prevent side effects or even catch any signs of toxicity that we can monitor for. Besides medications, they can have surgical removal of the epileptic focus to prevent the spread of activity through the brain. So there is a significant number of people whose epilepsy cannot be controlled with medications, and only once the medications have failed are they a candidate for surgery. That's when they can go in and remove that area within the brain to stop the spread of the seizure itself. Benefits of the surgery include reduction or cessation in frequency of seizures. Just because they're having a surgery doesn't mean they're going to have a lot of benefit, but that it is a possibility. To meet the requirements for surgery, they have to have the epilepsy diagnosis confirmed. They have to have their adequate trial with drug therapy without any satisfactory results. And electroclinical syndrome is defined. And you don't necessarily need to know what that is, but just know before anyone who has epilepsy can have surgery, they have to meet some defining criteria. The next slide is not gerontologic considerations on drug therapy. I had labeled that wrong. Oops, for me. Sorry about that. This is more just talks about more of the collaborative care and the different types of surgeries and surgery options that are out there for people with seizure disorders and epilepsy. Other care we can do on the next slide, slide 50, it talks about vagal nerve stimulation. That is a procedure where they surgically insert and program a vagal nerve stimulator into the patient, and patients can activate it with a magnet when they sense a seizure is imminent. The exact mechanism of action is actually unknown, although the stimulation may interrupt synchronization of epileptic brain wave activity. So that's a newer trial they're using. Also, biofeedback is something where they're seeing to have some benefits. It is used to control seizures, and it teaches the patient to maintain certain brainwave frequency that is refractory to seizure activity. So we're kind of just teaching our brain to stay more in the calm, quiet mode and not hyper-excite the neurons during that time. And again, that has proven to be somewhat effective. Nursing management, I know this is getting long, we are almost done here. Nursing management, again, look at the subjective and objective data. Nursing diagnosis should make sense to us depending on where in the seizure we are at. Ineffective breathing pattern, risk for injury, ineffective coping, ineffective health management. Overall goals, seizure-free of seizures if we can help prevent them, but safety is the other number one thing we can do. Maintaining optimal functioning while taking anti-seizure medications is also going to be very important. We need to, in prevention, wear a helmet if the patient is at risk for a head injury. Diet, exercise, know what are possible triggers and avoid them if at all possible. If you are there with a seizure, if you are walking in and your patient is starting to have a seizure, what do you do? The bottom part of the slide talks about that, and I really want you to focus on that. Observation and treatment of the seizure, the first thing we need to do is get them on their side, get them to a side-lying position. They may aspirate, they may bring something up. If they are in a chair, obviously we need to get them to the floor, but we want to have them on their side. Maintain a patent airway. We're doing it by turning them on their side. Their tongue also is not falling back to the back of their throat and cutting off their airway if they are on their side. Support the head. Loosen constrictive clothing east of the floor. They may require suctioning or oxygen after the seizure, but one thing I really want you to understand too is never put anything in their mouth. If they're clenching their teeth really tightly, sometimes patients can actually bite off their tongue in a severe situation, but we don't want to put anything in their mouth because they actually can bite that off and swallow it, or it can impede the airway. So we never want to put anything in their mouth to help open the airway. Just turn them to their side. That's the best thing we can do. When a seizure does occur, we need to carefully also observe and record details of the events because the diagnosis and subsequent treatment often rests solely on the seizure description. So all aspects of the seizure should be noted. What events preceded the seizure? When did the seizure occur? How long did each phase, the oral, if they had it, ictal or post-ictal last? So the seizure itself and then the recovery period afterwards. What occurred during each phase? So again, ABCs are our first priority, but as we are doing that, we need to be thinking, I need to be documenting this and observing so you can write down the notes of the seizure itself. When they're at home, the next slide talks about ambulatory and home care. Let me just take one step back. There is an emergency management table in your textbook on page 1495. It is table 59-8, and that would probably be a good thing to review as well. All right, home and ambulatory care. Instructions are important to adherence to medications, not just dose themselves. They need to make sure they're following their orders from their physician. If they miss a dose of their medication, it can be made up if the omission is remembered within 24 hours. Keeping their appointments. Family members need to be aware of the seizure disorder as well and what to do if a seizure occurs. They should wear med alert bracelets. Driving laws also relate to patients who have had a seizure, varying from state to state, so there's not one golden rule to remember with driving. But for example, some states require 3-month seizure-free period before issuing or reissuing a driver's license, whereas others actually can require up to a full year. So we need to just help patients understand that. In evaluation, monitor appropriate heart rate and rhythm, depth of respirations. During the seizure itself, we want to prevent injury. Have them verbalize knowledge of potential injury and take precautions to prevent injury. Acceptance of the disorder can be hard for the patient as well as the family, but again, medications can do a great job in controlling it, so helping them understand that they can have a functional life even with a seizure disorder. Understanding their medications they're on and their drug levels, also compliance with a therapeutic regimen. Non-adherence actually accounts for 50% of medication failures, so we need to make sure that they adhere appropriately to maintain the best life that they can. So let's quick end. We have a rest stop here in the slides as well, and I'm going to just finish with this one. The nurse is called to the patient's room by the patient's spouse when the patient experiences a seizure. Upon finding the patient in a clonic reaction, the nurse should, I'll let you read through those a second. As we had emphasized in the previous discussion, the best thing we can do is actually maintain a patent airway. And to do that, we need to turn the patient to their side. So the correct answer here would be one. So we may start oxygen, but it's not going to do much if their breathing pattern is irregular anyway. We do not restrain them to prevent injury. We can actually make things worse by putting on a restraint. And yes, we will need to do four, absolutely, but that is not a priority in this situation because the question says, upon finding the patient in a clonic reaction, what do we need to do? And our first response always needs to be ABCs, and we will document later. So that is going to end the podcast for epilepsy and seizure disorder. We will pick up again with the next podcast talking about multiple sclerosis. If you have any questions, please ask.